Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. We're continuing in our endeavors, our journey, along with the rest of the province, as we explore the NDP leadership race. We're having conversations with all of the NDP leadership candidates, and we're going to continue those conversations tonight. I'm very excited to welcome to the program. I'm not going to do a big, long introduction, because if I did, I'd spend the first 15 minutes listing off all of the things that this next individual has done, and then I wouldn't have those 15 minutes to talk to that individual. So I'm just going to say, welcome to the program, Nahed Nenshi. Mr. Nenshi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks. Thanks so much for having me. I'm just going to proceed now to read a 15-minute long bio of myself in order to avoid your difficult questions for as long as possible. Let me just say, and I normally don't say this to interviewers because that's just not how it works, but I want to say to you, Nate, thanks for all the work you're doing. Thank you for your service as a public servant, but thank you for your service on The Breakdown. There has been no one who has kept this government to account the way you have kept this government to account. I think I am your most frequent retweeter. The stuff that you've been able to do on top of your real life, serving citizens, has really been extraordinary. And in a time when we're losing local journalism so much, holding these folks to account is amazing. And you actually have to listen to Danielle every Saturday morning, so I apologize for that.
Well, the nice thing is like, there's these periods where she only does the radio show every 2 weeks. So I get like a week
every
off.
Every 2 weeks. See, I didn't even realize that we were not subjected to that every week.
Yeah, no, the breaks are precious. Well, thank you for saying that, sir. But I don't want to spend this time talking about me. We're here to talk about you. You're running for the NDP leadership. Before we get into that stuff, though, I do want to ask you to, and this might sound a little bit strange because you are a high profile figure in Alberta politics and certainly Calgary politics, but I do want to ask you to introduce yourself to the audience, anybody who's listening, anybody who's watching. Who is Nahed Nenshi?
Sure. Well, here we go. So I'm Nahed Nenshi, and I am running to be leader of Alberta's NDP and your next premier. I've been practicing saying that because it's been tough to have made that jump over a long period of time. But I'll tell you a little bit about me. I was born in Canada to immigrant parents who had just arrived when my mother was pregnant. And so I always say that I was born in Canada, but made in Africa. And when I was 18 months old, I did my research and collected the briefing book analysis and convinced my parents that our future was in the West. So we packed up all of our belongings in a 1974 Dodge Dart and drove across the country and settled in Northeast Calgary. So I grew up mostly in Northeast Calgary, though in the late 1970s, my parents decided that it was a perfect time to invest in a business adjacent to the oil, to the booming oil economy. And we bought a motel just outside of Red Deer. And so I grew up in the little house that was attached to the motel. Went to County Red Deer schools, and my family have always been small business people. We've always been entrepreneurs. We've just not been very good at it. And so, buying a motel that entirely relied on oil field workers and opening that up in 1979, probably not the smartest timing ever. So we lost everything in the early 80s global recession, came back to Calgary, and then had a series of ventures, the most lasting of which was a little laundromat in Forest Lawn on 17th Avenue, now called the Forest Laundry. And I wish I had come up with that name because I think that's one of the best names ever. But that was the new owners after we left that. A variety of things. So I was talking to the Alberta Chambers of Commerce yesterday, and I said, when they do these sort of profiles of people, they always ask you, what was your first job? And that's sort of a nonsensical question for someone who grew up in a family business, because there was no time that you were not working. Whether you were delivering towels to the rooms in the motel or doing your homework at the front counter of the laundromat while you're giving people change. That's sort of just how I grew up. And as you folks have heard me say before, my family was sometimes poor. Sometimes we were very poor. Sometimes we were slightly less poor, but we grew up in a family that, worked hard, that struggled hard, but we were able to do that in a community that believed in my success, that believed in everyone's success. And by that, I mean, I never thought that the public schools that I went to were anything short of excellent. You know, I haunted the public library on Saturdays. There's a story in there, Nate, which is that for years I've been saying that I was allowed to sign out more books from the public library per week. I had special dispensation from the librarians to sign out more than 30 books a week. And when I became mayor, a few years after I became mayor, I met a woman who walked up to me and said, you know, I used to work at the Forest Lawn Public Library. And I said, oh, that's part of my life story. I tell that story all the time. And she said, I know, because I remember you. And I said, okay. And she goes, do you want to know a secret? And I said, do I? And she said, yeah, there was never a limit on the number of books. You could sign out as many as you want. We just told you that to make you feel special. but that was sort of my life. And my life was defined by the fact that these public services were there for us. And when my dad got sick, the public healthcare system was there for us. It was always there for us. And to me, I attribute a lot of my success to that. So in any case, to shorten the story, I did a degree in business at the University of Calgary, where I was president of the Students' Union. I worked for many years in big business, working with some of the largest businesses in North America, living and working all over the world. I did my graduate work in the U.S. And then in 2001, my dad got sick again, and I decided that it was time to come home. And so I came home to Calgary. I decided to make my life here. You know, I literally applied for jobs and had opportunities all over the world. But I decided that I wanted to make my home in this place that had given me so much when I grew up. So I moved back here, started my own business, ran my own consulting firm with clients ranging from the United Nations to the Gap. And eventually, I got a call from an old professor of mine who said, hey, I always thought you'd be a good teacher. Do you want to come give it a try? And started a new career as an academic, became a tenured professor in the field of nonprofit management at Mount Royal University, wrote a little book on the future of Canadian cities that sort of made me an expert on cities and the future of cities, did a bunch of media commentary. And then without getting into that long story, was convinced by enough people that I couldn't be a bystander and a policy influencer anymore, that I had to be a policy maker. And that led to 3 terms as mayor of Calgary, 11 years. And for the last couple of years, I've been living a wonderful, wonderful life where I have the freedom to only do the stuff that I want to do. I've created a great professional life that paid me way more than being mayor and working way less. And focusing only on things that I love. So I've been having a terrific life, and I've just decided to ruin it all.
I was just going to say, if you know, you're singing the praises of the new life, and you're moving to something that would be the by most accounts, the polar opposite. I mean, 30 books a week.
Yeah, they weren't big books. I like science fiction novels, a lot of Doctor Who novelizations in there. But then I would go, I'm such a nerdy kid. Then I would go off, well, nerdy kids still. But then I would go off on sort of obsessions, right? So at one point, I think this was more late high school, university days, I decided that I was dissatisfied with the English curriculum because we were not reading enough great Canadian novels. So I remember I went off on an obsession where I was like, okay, I have to read all the Margaret Lawrence and all the Margaret Atwood and all the Robertson Davies. And I took a very long bus ride to university every day. And in fact, one of the things that I regret is when we completely revamped the bus system in Calgary and created the bus rapid transit lines, including the Max Purple, which is called the Max Purple for a reason. That's the one that goes from East Calgary to downtown. I inadvertently, in doing that and doing a huge new route design, we got rid of the 72-73 circle route, which was always my bus. That took me from Marlborough to the university. It was a 50-minute bus ride, 5-0, and I would read on it. By the way, the point of my story is that I would read on it, and people would be like, oh, are you an English major that you're reading all these books? And I was like, no, I'm a business major, but I just figured I needed to read these books. But I'm just doing that for fun. But I realized in our revamping of the bus route network that we made life better for almost everybody. And the one hypothetical person whose life was much worse because of the new, more efficient bus routes was the kid growing up in Marlboro who went to the University of Calgary, who no longer had one bus that would take him all the way there. And I was like, I've screwed myself over, at least my 30 years ago self. So in any case, so that was me. And I'm still a bit that way. And, you know, getting onto that topic, you know, I just finished doing Canada Reads for the CBC, and which is one of the just a fabulous experience in trying to get more people excited about reading and books in general, and also about this amazing book that I found called Denison Avenue. Denison Avenue had sold about 300 or 400 copies in a year since it came out. And once we launched it on Canada Reads, it has now been the number one best-selling Canadian book. Even though we were eliminated pretty quickly on Canada Reads, it's still the number one best-selling book. So it has been the number one best-selling book, Canadian book in Canada, I think 5 of the last 6 weeks. And so I'm really excited that we've gotten more people interested in doing that. But the character I was playing on Canada Reads, quote unquote, which is actually really me, is the guy who has let books leave his life. And, you know, I used to be such a voracious reader. And ever since I became mayor, you know, I read a lot, but I was reading 3,000 page council agendas, not stuff that was edifying. And so what I was trying to do is show people that even if you're busy, you can find time to bring books into your life. And for me, it was eliminating screen time a little bit. You know, for me, I travel a lot. I traveled a lot. And so I stopped watching movies on the plane, and I use that as my reading time. For other people, it'll be in different places, but I've been trying to encourage people to bring literacy back into their lives. Did you know this was going to be a book talk podcast, Nate?
I had no idea what it was going to be. I was open to. I do have some points I'm going to make sure that I get.
Yeah, we should probably talk about what we need to talk about here.
Well, I mean, there's this leadership race. So before we get to the leadership race, there's a couple of other pieces that I want to hit on real quick, because what you're describing is a significant background in policy, a significant background in sort of the academia of things, the understanding of things, and you made the shift from how the things work to making the things work with the mayoral campaign. Was it just that people were like, hey, you shouldn't be just coming up with the policy ideas, you should actually be implementing them? Was there anything else that drove the... Because politics is a fascinating beast.
Yeah, that's a really it's a really insightful question. I tell this story a lot, which is my work at the university. I'm a terrible researcher. I'm a slightly better than terrible teacher, but I'm a terrible researcher. But my research, because I'm too lazy to do stuff that has no impact in the world. And so my research, such that it was focused on two things. One was kind of the future of cities. I'm not a planner by training, but I sort of self-taught in the field of how cities work and how cities run. There's a longer story of how that happened, but I just love cities. And so I was really pontificating a lot on cities and how they work. I was a prolific media commentator. I had a column in the Calgary Herald on that sort of thing, mostly about cities. And I kind of found myself in the role of being almost the official opposition to the then civic government, because no one else was doing it. So I was kind of filling in a role. But my second part of my research was around civic engagement, how and why people get involved in their communities and how we get more people getting involved in their communities. And so the nexus of those two things obviously was municipal politics. And I helped found and work with a couple of groups, the Better Calgary campaign and Civic Camp, which were really just about getting people involved in conversations about the future of their city. So that was kind of my job. And through my work, I realized that it's actually very easy to get people involved in their community. You just have to ask them. You know, the research is very clear. The number one reason people don't volunteer is not, I don't have time, or I don't have money, or I don't care. It's nobody asked me. It never occurred to me. So my Three Things for Canada program that I've been running for many years, which just encourages every citizen every year to do at least 3 acts of community service, is just an example of asking people. But what we learned through that work is that it's relatively easy to get people to volunteer in their community. It's actually extremely difficult to get people to volunteer or to work in politics. and in electoral campaigns. So as kind of a nerdy guy, I turned my thoughts to, all right, how do we get young people and people who are really involved in their community more interested in politics? So there's a longer story, but believe it or not, the stories can be even longer. But through the years of kind of 2008, 2009, I decided that I was going to try single-handedly to improve the level of municipal governance in Calgary. And I was going to do that by convincing good people to run for office. So I went to endless lunches and dinners with community leaders, CEOs, PTA moms, community volunteers, young people that I just thought were smart and engaged, and tried to convince them to run for office. And I struck out every time. Every single person said no. And I've been making this joke for 12 years. I probably need to stop making it, which is I struck out particularly with women. And I'm very used to striking out with women, but this was different. And it really was women in particular were saying the adversarial system that we've created, there's no room there for me. It doesn't make sense for my family. I don't want my kids to go through that. And I kept thinking, you know, there's got to be a way to change the game, and the players make the game. So if we get better people in place, then we can have a better system of government. And I kept saying that to people. And finally, people were saying, you know, if you really believe that, why aren't you putting your money where your mouth is? And why aren't you doing it yourself? And I said, well, you know, I'm not a politician. Yeah, I was the president of the students' union. I've always been around politics. But, you know, to be a politician, you have to be good looking and charismatic. You have to kind of like people and children and puppies, decision making. I don't like any of those things. This is not right for me. I'm the guy, the nerdy guy and the nerdy schlubby professor guy in the background who will give the ideas. But enough people said to me, you know, you talk constantly about not being a bystander and being engaged in your community. Why don't you put your skills towards this work? So it took me a long, does this sound familiar? It took me a long time to decide. I talked to a lot of people. And I kind of went away and put my thinking hat on and thought, okay, well, I don't want to run so that people can say, thank you for elevating the level of debate and kind of tap me on the head, right? I want to run to win. I'm not going to waste my time and other people's money on this unless there's a real chance of winning. I don't want to bring up people's hopes. So we sat down and wrote a strategy. How does a guy who's not very well known outside of wonky political circles, who doesn't have any money, who looks like me, who talks like me, how does a guy like that actually win an election against people who are well-funded, who've been running on this for years, and who know what they're doing? Again, does this sound familiar? So with the exception of the well-known part. So in the end, we wrote the strategy, we executed on that strategy. And what was remarkable to me is, again, does this sound familiar? Almost from the day we launched, we found that we had tapped into something that people hadn't tapped into before, which was a real sense of hope and optimism about what was possible. Our political culture in Alberta at that time had become kind of sclerotic. It had become kind of stuck, right? And people were just willing to accept what was there. And I tapped into this feeling, not just among young people. Everyone thinks it was just among young people, but among people throughout the community, that we can do better. And somehow people figured that I could be the conduit for their hopes for the future. It's something I've taken very seriously. And in the end, you know, three elections later, leaving office with super high approval ratings at the end, if you believe in such things. And I think that was entirely based on the fact that people still saw me as that conduit for the better community that they wanted.
What's the beef with puppies?
Puppies, children. Oh. And you know, I had to learn the number one rule of politics: kiss the babies, shake the hands, never get it backwards. But
I mean, you got to love puppies, though. Cats, not so much, but puppies.
Oh, controversy erupts on the breakdown.
Wouldn't be the first time. I'm going to use this as the opportunity to pivot to the today stuff. I mean, I could spend a boatload of time talking about the floods and how, for many people, your involvement in the floods, and particularly the recovery thing, was different than what a lot of people expected from their politicians of the day. But instead of spending time on that, I want to talk a little bit about the speech that you gave. And I'm sure that this is the first time that anyone's asked you this question. So it's going to be,
I haven't done any interviews. So you're the very first one.
But I know there's people who have asked, hey, was that the soft launch? And I know that there's people who have asked, hey, was that the moment? Was it scripted? Was it deliberate? But as somebody who was there that day, the Breakdown was live tweeting that event and doing some pictures and our brand of acerbic commentary, there was something fundamentally different about that speech than the speeches that we've seen from politicians on, I'm going to go pretty much any level of government. And I'm pretty sure that if you had said at the end of that speech, oh, by the way, I'm running for NDP leadership, you can buy memberships over here, you would have sold a membership to probably everybody in that crowd. But it was...
I think I have, in fact, sold a membership to everybody in that crowd this week. But yes.
There was an authenticity that was present in that speech. It was not performative. It was not... restrained. It was, there's people who have said Nenshi unleashed. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that speech. I mean, I was normally the way that I go the flow of the questions with the NDP candidates is I get to the trans stuff at the end. But in many ways, publicly, that was sort of the beginning. So talk about that.
Yeah, so I'll let you in on the real story there, which is, there was no strategy there, none whatsoever. So what had happened is probably starting last autumn, because I'm answering the question underneath your question as well. So starting last autumn, one person would call me every 2 or 3 weeks and say, want to be the premier of Alberta? Rachel Notley is going to step down at some point. You could be the leader of the NDP. And I started by laughing, and then I went to hanging up on him. But then he started talking to other people and started spreading the word a little bit. But I wasn't really interested in doing it. And in reality, he, and I'll mysteriously tell you, no, I'll just tell you who it was, Zane Velji, never actually thought I would go for it. It was kind of his bit. Right. And in reality, what he was trying to do was to see if I would get, because he is actually a New Democrat, and he was trying to see if he could get me more engaged in the party, help them figure out their path forward and how to win and who the right leadership candidate would be. But, it was always couched in, you must do it. You must do it. So that had been going on for a while. And I really wasn't at all interested. And in fact, I met with some of the leadership candidates, some of the existing leadership candidates. And I remember one meeting, and I remember the weather was nice, so it was probably in the early autumn, where she actually said, some people say you're going to run. And I just laughed. And then I met her again at Christmas. And I said, just to be completely frank with you, all these people have been talking to me, so there's maybe a 5 or 6% chance that I might want to move forward with this, but I'm always open and transparent. So I want you to know that that's going on. And we laughed about that. And then a bunch of things happened. One thing happened was when it got really, really cold in January and we were in a grid alert. As you've alluded to, I've managed a lot of emergencies in my time, for better or worse. And I know what a grid alert means. And so I thought, oh, geez, it was a Friday. It was 4 o'clock. The typical electricity peak is on weekdays between 4 and 7. And I won't get into all the details on how electricity generation works, but you have to manage the peaks. And so I thought, all right, well, I better go online and tell people we're in a grid alert. So please, even if your dishwasher is running, stop at mid-cycle. Don't use your washer dryer right now. If you can delay cooking dinner, delay cooking dinner just for a couple of hours. And that will sort everything out, unplug your vehicles, whatever. So, it's pretty straightforward stuff and it's not very controversial. And I got online and started tweeting all of this because I still have, I think, a larger Twitter X. I still have a larger X audience, I think, than the Premier does. So I thought I can amplify some of this stuff. And then I realized, so I went to see what the government was actually saying so that I could retweet and amplify. And I realized that they weren't saying anything except they were using it as an opportunity to punch Stephen Gilbo in the face. I get it. It's tempting to punch Stephen Gilbo in the face, but when you're in an actual emergency, there are other priorities. And that was made me suddenly realize that one thing, because had we gone into rolling blackouts when it was minus 45, minus 50 in northern Alberta, people could be very hurt. And I realized that, geez, this government doesn't actually know how to be a government. They only know how to be politicians and, frankly, not very good ones. And that really hit me hard, because what most people don't realize is when you're the mayor, the stuff that people read in the newspaper, the legislative stuff, the council stuff, and so on, is maybe 20% of your job. You know, half of your job is actually running a complex organization and getting smart on the files and supporting the wonderful city colleagues who are doing the work. And then there's a part of your job that is a little amorphous, but it is about being the leader, you know, showing up during emergencies, not as a politician, but as the person who can give people the advice they need, the information they require at this time to keep themselves safe. It's about embodying the spirit of the city in a way that is not political. It's not about the people who voted for you, the people who didn't vote for you, but being the representative of the city and what it is. And so it occurred to me that this UCP government only does the first part. They're not really particularly interested in running the province, and they're not particularly interested in embodying the higher ideals, particularly in times of crisis. So that was very troubling to me. And at that point, I was like, geez, does anyone have that same insight? Because I actually, you know, was flattering myself by saying that is a blinding insight, right? And what does that mean? And then the trans stuff happened. And no, that was not part of a strategy. I did not put Danielle Smith up to putting out that hateful video so that I would have something to respond to. But I was really, really struck by it. And so I heard that there was going to be a rally on the Saturday. The Friday was my birthday. And so I kind of was taking a retired guy's birthday and just enjoying my day, put my phone in my pocket and was just running errands with friends and having like the quietest, simplest day. Went to Lunchbox Theater, went out for lunch, and my phone was buzzing like crazy. And I wasn't even looking at it. And I was just thinking to myself, isn't that nice? Everyone's sending me happy birthday wishes. And what I didn't realize is that there were two different things actually happening. A bunch of people really, really upset about these vulnerable children and the impact that these policies are going to have on these vulnerable children. But also, somehow, you know, because a lot of people have been asking me about the NDP leadership, and I had just put out this like very simple, what we call in the biz, the holding statement that said, well, I'm not thinking about it. And I'll probably have something to say in a month, right? And though someone, one of the journalists had picked up on that, Bill Kaufman at the Calgary Herald, and to be fair, he had tried to reach me that morning, but I was just birthdaying. And so I hadn't seen his message, and he ran with the story anyway. So I didn't realize that there was a huge story that was basically, will he or won't he, that was also on the front page of the Calgary Sun, will he or won't he, the next morning. I didn't realize this was all going on, and that was why my phone was blowing up. What are you doing? What is happening, right? No strategy whatsoever. And then when I arrived at the rally, I walked up to the organizer. There's a little more to it, but the short version is, the organizer had suggested, she had heard I was coming and had suggested, does he want to speak? So I walked up to her and I said, well, why do you want me to speak? I'm just kind of an old retired guy, right? And she said, no, I've heard you speak at Pride many times, and you always give a very political speech at Pride, not a celebratory speech that reminds us of how to fight for human rights. So I need you to fire up this crowd, and I want you to be the last speaker. And so I was like, okay, I hadn't prepared a thing. And I had made a terrible error. It's almost like I don't know how to live in Calgary, because I'd been out and about the day before and it was a beautiful day. And so when I woke up that morning, I heard, oh, it's going to rain. And in my tiny lizard brain, I interpreted that as beautiful day of yesterday plus a little bit of rain. So I dressed like it was the Calgary Folk Festival.
It was cold.
Wearing a pride t-shirt and like a little mountain equipment wind jacket, which actually makes you colder because it wicks everything away from your body. And I was freezing. I usually don't get cold, but I was so cold. And then I thought I needed everyone to see my purple pride straight but not narrow t-shirt. So I unzipped my jacket just before I went on stage. I was freezing. So people were like, oh, he's shaking with passionate intensity, right? I was actually shivering. And Carla had told me to fire up the crowd. But I also had to fire myself up because I was worried I was getting into hypothermia. So, but then I looked at those kids and they just looked so worried. And I remembered this non-binary student at Henry Wisewood High School that I had talked to a year before, who had asked me if they had any future in Alberta and if they were safe in Alberta. And I remember saying to that kid, you know what? I've known Danielle Smith for 30 years. There's a lot to disagree with about her. She is many, many things, but she's not a hater. She's got a non-binary family member. She's not going to go after you. She's going to stand up against that. You're going to be safe. And I stood there and looked at all those kids, and who knows, that person may have been in the audience that day. And I just thought, I lied to that kid. I was wrong. And I just felt so awful. But then I stood there and I realized I've still got a voice. I still got power. And at the very, very least, I can let these kids know that people with voices and some semblance of power are in their corner. And that's really what that was about. And so that led to, and it was all just impromptu. I probably thought for 5 minutes as other people were speaking what I was going to say. And, you know, then now all the speculation started. And all these people were like, that was his soft launch. He was kicking off this campaign because the front page of the Calgary Sun had will he or won't he, right, that day. But that really wasn't it at all. I know I was in that moment and I was thinking about how do we organize to stop this. But it also led to a lot more conversations with folks saying, you got to do this. And so I really did take the time. I had some contractual things, some work things, because I actually have a job, right? That would have prevented me from announcing until the very end of the first week of March anyway. And so I said, you know what? I'll actually use this as an opportunity to talk to people. I was already 10, 15% there, especially after that cold weather. I was probably closer to 50% after that cold weather response. But I talked to members of the NDP. I talked to people who have never voted NDP before, every corner of the province, to really test saying, look, these are the things I believe in. Is this what the party believes in? You know, yes, of course, I know the party believes in strong provision of public services and in protecting the vulnerable, all of that stuff, I know. But does the party believe in building a strong economy and supporting the energy sector? Does the party believe in actually not being performative on climate change, but doing meaningful things on climate change that portray Alberta as a world leader that people should follow instead of being a bystander on climate change? Do we believe in balancing the budget? Right? These things that I believe in. And I realized as I'm talking to people that actually today's Alberta NDP is really that. And so then I went, geez, I didn't even realize that this party that Rachel Notley and so many others have built has actually become a place that holds the values that I hold. And, you know, more and more Albertans don't know, I think, that party is that. There's a lot of baggage, right? And so if I can use my limited set of skills here to actually bring light to that, then maybe this makes sense. And fundamentally, that is how I ended up doing all of this. And, you know, there was some speculation that I was taking so long because I was being totally strategic somehow, or that the party was trying to freeze me out or put up barriers in my way. It's not true at all. It's not true at all. The party was welcoming and super helpful. I talked to all of the other candidates who were welcoming and super helpful. And, you know, like, give me advice, have been giving me advice on places in Alberta that I don't know very well. So that's been really actually quite wonderful. And as I've been having the conversations with Albertans, I suddenly realized, you know what? There is something here for me. Anyway, Nate, I'm trying to answer your questions much more short now because I feel like you've gotten through three of them.
Well, you kind of touched on some of them. I mean, I have to ask, you did endorse the NDP in the 2023 election. So there had to have been some awareness of mutual alignment, or was that endorsement purely like Danielle Smith she's done some things already. I'd like her to not do more things. What was that endorsement for you?
Well, it was a bit of both, you know, and I will say that it was driven by your very polite analysis of Premier Smith's government there. But also the fact that, look, we were in a situation where there was only one other choice. And so what I had done is I'd written a series of columns that were just talking about basically taking the stance of, if you're someone who's never considered voting, if you're someone who has always voted conservative, but you understand that this Danielle Smith version of conservative is not Ralph Klein or Peter Lougheed, you know, what are you to do? And so I'd done a bunch of stuff around just helping people think through that decision, but I hadn't explicitly said you should vote for the NDP. And I wasn't planning on doing that because I'm a political commentator. You know, that's not kind of the world that I live in. And then I realized as we were getting closer and closer to the election after the Jennifer Johnson incident, where she compared trans kids to poop and cookies, and Danielle took many days to actually do something about it, I realized that this is actually high stakes and I need to do this. So that's how I ended up doing that. But I used terminology like you should lend your vote to the NDP and make them earn your future vote, right? And I still believe that everyone who votes for you, you can't count on them forever. They're all lending your vote. And you have to earn that vote every single time. And so that's how I ended up doing that. And certainly that opened the doors to a different kind of conversation. But that conversation came about quite a bit later.
I want to rattle through some policy things really quick.
Yeah.
So because there's some policy things that I feel like we absolutely need to hit on. You know, if you become the next leader of the NDP, what's your vision for Alberta's economy? And inside of that, I'm going to ask you to include the piece, because we've seen what a government can do when it decides, hey, you know what, that's a real nice mountain there. It would be nicer if it wasn't there. And we've seen the reopening of the conversation around the Grassy Mountain coal mines. What's your thought on the coal mining piece? What's your thought on Alberta's economy going forward?
Coal mining piece is easy. That was easy. And, you know, I haven't been deeply engaged in that, but I was a little bit, because that was when I was mayor. And got city council to unanimously pass a motion rejecting that kind of work, working with Mayor Snodgrass in High River, as well as with Cor Blund and his group of rancher activists opposed to that. But the real issue with the coal mining is not just the coal mining, it's the incredible dishonesty with which the government has put this forward. And now they are turning themselves into not saying this is not a new project. And Premier actually said, I think I read about it on the breakdowns, because the breakdown listens to the radio show, so I don't have to. Basically said something like, this is a reclamation project, and the only way to reclaim the mountain is by building a huge coal mine in it and 20 years later reclaiming that mine. I don't use rude language. I'm weird in politics that way. I don't cuss. But can we just say, what the fuddle-duddle does that even mean? And so, you know, that's just, it's a great example of the rank dishonesty of this government. And why? Who's getting enriched? What lobbyist is in her ear? talking about this. This is such an easy political win to just say no. And it's, you're not really going to make any money off of this deal. So who are you listening to? And that's a question you can ask about so many of these decisions, these inexplicable decisions that this government is making. Who's getting enriched? Follow the money, right? What's actually happening here? The broader question on the economy is, and you know, this is something I really had to test with NDP supporters. I worked really, really hard on getting the Trans Mountain expansion done. You know, I'm the mayor of Calgary. It doesn't even go to Calgary. But it's absolutely, I believe that it was absolutely critical for the future wealth of the province. And I heard Rachel Notley in her exit interview on CBC's The Current with Matt Galloway, a show with, you know, almost as many listeners as The Breakdown. And I have a terrible habit, which is that whenever I hear a politician being interviewed, I always say, okay, how would I have answered that question? And in that particular case, I went, geez, I would have answered the questions exactly the same way Rachel Notley answered those questions, which also helped me with my decision. I happened to be talking to Rachel Notley that day about my decision, and I told her that, and she was like, sorry, what? But we specifically talked about the Trans Mountain, and she and I worked really hard on that to convince the Prime Minister to make the moves he made against fierce opposition from the NDP Premier of British Columbia. And so, you know, I believe that we are blessed with abundant natural resources in this province, and we are squandering it by selling them at less than the world price. And not, it's the worst thing you can do for the economy and for the environment, and not actually using that money to invest in a more sustainable economic future. So I believe in supporting the energy sector. I believe in an all hands-on-deck energy strategy, from renewables to oil and gas to hydrogen to everything in between, and really figuring out how to support that and not scaring away investment because we're ideologically opposed to it. You know, this week I spoke with the Alberta Chambers of Commerce very briefly, all of the candidates did, and the point that I was really trying to make there is that business uncertainty is what kills the ability to grow the economy. So we got to support small business. We got to support small business to scale up to medium business. And we got to support big business in this province. But also, we have resigned ourselves to being bystanders in the fight against climate change. So it's being done to us. But here in this province, we've got the smartest engineers in the world, many of whom are working in the Canadian energy sector. We really need to be at the cutting edge of innovative ways of supplying energy to the world that are environmentally sustainable. We need to be at the front of that rather than seeing it as something that's done to us. And so building out the economy really is about ensuring that we are a beacon of innovation. It's investing in post-secondaries, working with businesses on private R&D, not putting all of our eggs in one basket of carbon capture and storage. And right now, this government is actually way behind industry and innovation. The industry is way more innovative. So, you know, we have a premier who continually says we want to be net zero by 2050, and then continually says no to every single action that would make us net zero by 2050. It's very clear what she's doing. It's very cynical and it's very hypocritical. She's just pushing the ball down the field the same way the Harper Conservatives did when they were in power, that said, we have these targets, but they're so far away that we're never going to actually have to do anything to meet them. And then in 2049, it'll be someone else's problem. And I just don't think that way.
Would you lift the renewables moratorium? I mean, the moratorium has been lifted, but...
The moratorium has been lifted, but somehow it's okay to have a coal mine on the side of a mountain, but a wind turbine in a wheat field is somehow offensive and it ruins the view. It's stupid. The whole thing is stupid. And I know the renewables industry has been very gracious in saying, no, we can work with these rules and so on. But, you know, that billions and billions of dollars investment that went away, it's not coming back easily. And we need a policy that is business friendly in all aspects in that way.
Yeah, it blows my mind that you could go to the Grassy Mountain, you could do the mines, you could risk the water supply for Southern Alberta, but you could not put up a solar panel over there because you'd ruin the view. That the dissonance that exists there. I've only got you for a couple more minutes, so I want to make sure I hit on this part. Housing. and the houselessness crisis. We've seen some very aggressive moves from the UCP in regards to, I mean, the city of Edmonton, but really, it's the UCP that's very clearly driving the bus on that one towards the houselessness crisis, towards encampments. What are your thoughts on that piece?
You know, as some folks, at least in Calgary, might know, I made the centerpiece of my third term as mayor, Calgary's creating Canada's first community-based action plan on mental health and addiction. So you asked two very different questions. One is about vulnerable people and one is about housing. And homelessness or houselessness kind of spans both of those things. And one of the challenges that we've really got here is on the front one, you know, we've got this Alberta model of mental health and addiction. And one thing I really give a bunch of praise to the Premier and her Chief of Staff, Marshall Smith, for is the work they've done on treatment, which is, you know, Canada leading, having funded treatment beds that you don't have to pay for, building out recovery communities. That's good. That's good stuff. And I'm not taking anything away from that, because for the people who need it, to have it available at the moment you need it, it's part of our mental health strategy. It's really important. But I also have to remorsefully and sadly call the Alberta model the failed Alberta model, because more and more people are dying. More and more people are experiencing social disorder. And, you know, the third element of Calgary's action plan is staying safe. And that means both people with mental illness or suffering from addiction need to be safe, but it also means that everyone in the community who encounters those folks needs to be safe. And we have failed at that. We're doing better in Calgary than in Edmonton, I think, but we have failed at it. And so we have got to figure that piece out. And look, I'll lay it on the line. Encampments are an example of a broken system. There have always been encampments. They've usually been hidden away. They're usually not in your face. And in some cases, we do have activists who perhaps have used the encampments for their own means. And I hate that, because I feel like that is using the vulnerable people. Because for some people, that's just a life choice that you've made. Maybe you've got a pet, maybe you've got a partner, maybe you can't handle shelter life, right? But to have huge encampments in the downtowns of all of our cities, right? That is a policy failure. And we owe it to the people who live in those encampments to figure out a way they can have a better life. That's critical. And so I'm not opposed, frankly, to the Edmonton Intervention Center model, right? Which is really a one-on-one focused model to work with people to say, all right, what are your circumstances? What do you need? How can we help you? The problem is that it has been caked in this huge ideology of there's something wrong with you and you're broken, and we're only helping you begrudgingly because we don't want you living in that tent that we have to see every day. So there is a, so it's not even, and I'm sure that the people who work in that intervention center, whatever they're calling it, are great people who are public servants who are really trying to help folks. But it's hard to escape the overall image that we're just trying to clear you people out because you don't belong in our downtowns. Now, out of all of that, and I've done a ton of work in, you know, 10-year plans to end homelessness. I was part of the National Housing Accord this year that developed a series of recommendations around housing and not just increasing supply, but increasing sustainable and affordable supply of housing. There's a whole bunch of things. I don't need to get into them with you now around housing. And the one thing I'm nervous about is now that everybody in every political party has agreed that we need to increase the supply of housing, we need to make sure we're not just increasing the supply of unaffordable and sustainable housing or housing that people can't afford to stay in once it's built. So there's a whole bunch of work to be done on that. And that has to be part of a really comprehensive housing strategy. And right now, I think the provincial government just doesn't have it.
I got to ask, you talked a lot about safety. You just ended by talking about the supply of housing. One of the things that the evidence has been very clear on, and certainly there's no shortage of first responders who have raised concerns about this, as well as community outreach groups who have raised concerns about this. The opioid supply in this province has become profoundly, profoundly toxic. People are mixing diabetic medications. People are mixing in toxic substances. I've asked every candidate so far for their thoughts on safe supply. And I know I only have like 2 minutes left with you, sir, but that's where that's a question that I absolutely can't just leave on the table. So tell me your thoughts on safe supply. Is that
I don't mind telling you, Nate, that I am probably a bit more quote unquote moralistic than a lot of folks in this space. I always say I'm like a Victorian grandmother in my life, but I'm also extremely driven by evidence. And so I didn't really love supervised consumption sites in concept when I was mayor, but I knew we had to have them. And one of my great regrets is that I'm the one who said in Calgary, we're just going to have one. We're going to have it at the Schumer. We're going to have it in a healthcare facility. We're going to study the heck out of it and figure out what works and what doesn't work before we expand it. And that was a policy error, because we centralized the problem. And, you know, we learned that as much as we want to believe that wraparound services are important, and they are, that they're not needed at the moment of consumption. So the moment you're using is not the moment that we say, and here's a brochure on rehab. You know, it just doesn't work, right? And I don't mean to belittle the work of the people that do that, but we need a more comprehensive answer. So on safe supply, I too, you know, share a lot of the concerns that people have around safe supply, around whether that's enabling self-destructive behavior, and diversion, by the way, is a real issue. If diversion of safe supply is actually causing easier supply for people who are not specifically getting the safe supply with the services that are needed, that's, you know, as much as they're, you know, dramatic about it in the UCP government, if that diversion is actually happening, that is a real issue. But that's not an issue with the concept of safe supply. It's an issue with how it is done, right? How it is actually implemented. So all of that said, that's a very long way of me getting to, we got to save lives. You can't treat people and you can't get people better if they're dead. And so we've had now, thankfully, a lot of evidence from our friends next door in British Columbia about what's working and what isn't working. It's not working that well. It's helping, but their per capita over, I'm trying to prevent myself from saying overdose and say drug poisoning. Their per capita drug poisoning rates haven't really gone down with the advent of safer, and I will never say safe supply because these drugs aren't safe, but I will say safer, right? That's why I don't use overdose, because that implies some dose is safe, right? But the safer supply in British Columbia, some of it has worked, some of it hasn't worked. Some of the stuff we do in Alberta that, you know, the government doesn't like to talk about, like opioid agnostic therapy and so on, is that, right? It's the same thing. We're just using different language. But ultimately, what we need to do is have this comprehensive view where people who are using are safer than they are now, so that we can keep them alive, and that we have lots of ability for them to improve their life. And I do start there. I do start by saying that a life of addiction is not the ideal life, and we need to help people get a better life. So I'm not dodging your question, but I am really trying to say it is very nuanced. And I'm not one of those like Danielle Smith who would just say, no, that's wrong. But I'm also not one who would say that will solve all of our problems.
Yeah. And the fundamental question that I think that I was going after, is there opposition to it, or is there open to the evidence and the proper execution of it?
I am always evidence-based. But you know, the evidence is that the BC model also hasn't worked the way people had hoped it would work.
The deaths didn't go up, though. In Alberta, we can't say the same thing.
That's true. I mean, they stabilized, but they stabilized at unspeakably high levels.
Yeah.
You know, when I was mayor, I would often say that the tipping point is if we lose one person per day in the city. And it was like two or three people per week. And now it's multiple people a day.
Yeah.
And so clearly something's not working.
This would normally be where I would say if there are any other final thoughts or closing thoughts, but I know that we've
But
already gone.
Nate, you know, I know I do have to go, but I want to. I was very, very, very verbose, even more than usual today. So, do you have lightning round? Do you have anything else you need to get me on the record for?
The biggest things I think we've kind of really already covered off. The only other, I'll ask you to do a couple minutes if you don't mind on the future of the NDP under an Enchi led NDP. Because I think that's one of the things that the questions that people are most sort of like, oh, will it still be the NDP or what will happen? And will he rebrand it and turn it to the Alberta Party for some reason? Don't do that. But
that's a really good name.
It is a good name. If only there was a good party to back it up.
I have a long history there, as people may or may not know. But in any case, yeah, look, you know, I want to be very clear that I was not there when there were two MLAs or when there were four MLAs. I did not do the hard work of building this party to what it is today. And the people who did that hard work, who built this house, need to know that they will always have a home in this house with me as the leader. Not going to get everything we want, because as we reach out to more and more Albertans, it means we're going to have more and more policy discussions within the party. But what I can promise everyone is that you'll always be heard, you'll always have a fair hearing, and we will work together to make our policy better. And I think the fact that I've been endorsed by probably one of the most left-wing members of the party, MLAs, and one of the most right-wing MLAs at the same time, and we're working on the team together, probably gives you a sense of how I would approach that whole thing. The N in NDP does not need to stand for Nenshi or Nahib, right? The same way that it doesn't stand for Notley. And so we have to be able to create that mechanism. And yes, I believe we need to modernize the Constitution. My bias right now is that the relationship with the federal party hurts more than it helps. But ultimately, that is a decision the members will make. And what I can offer is a fair, clear, transparent process to surface these questions and to let the members make those decisions. And I will absolutely put my opinion in, but I'm open to persuasion and the members will make that decision. But ultimately, what's been really exciting for me about this last week, which has gone beyond my wildest imaginings in terms of how excited people are, you know, in 2010, it took us about 7 months to sign up the largest number of campaign volunteers that had ever worked for a mayoral campaign. Got about 1,100 volunteers. And I don't mind telling you that in the first 2 days since we launched, we have approximately three times that signed up across the province. We had it wasn't a rally. People thought it was a rally, but we had volunteer training on day two. And I thought that we only invited people on Monday. You know, if you're free at 6:30 on Tuesday, come by. And I thought 20 or 30 people would show up for the volunteer training. And there are 500 people in the room.
And that photo was. I'm just going to jump in for 2 seconds here because I think that this really can't be overstated. One of the hardest things to get in a political campaign is engaged volunteers. Those people are gold for a political campaign. And when I saw that picture of the room of volunteers, I was just like, oh, damn.
I was too. Standing in the middle of that room. I was too. And I don't even think I had a mic. I don't think that we thought that there'd be that many people there. No, I think I did have a mic. I think they handed me a mic at some point. But in any case, that's not because of me. That's the thing that people need to realize. It's not because I'm so good looking and charismatic and people flock to me. I mean, look, I'm good looking, charismatic, but no, I'm not. But what it is I maybe inadvertently tapped into something which so many of those folks told me in that room was NDP hardcore. There are some in Calgary. It was a bunch of Team Nenshi Purple people. It was a bunch of people I've never met before. And the single most common thing I heard was, I've never bought a membership in a political party before, but I bought one for you for this. And The real feeling there was simply that people were feeling a sense of hope and optimism. For better or worse, our political discourse over the last, probably since about 2015, 2016 in this province, has been very negative. It's been very divisive. It's been grasping and clutching and defensive. So it's been, you know, we're every seizure mentality, everyone is against us. And we're against Ottawa, we're against environmentalists, we're against foreign influence, we're against, we're against, we're against, we're against. And I probably overthought it, but there is a reason that my campaign slogan is for Alberta, for all of us. That word for is really important. Little tiny three-letter word. But that is trying to remind people that we are blessed to live in one of the best places on earth. Abundant natural resources, abundant human resources. It's been a beacon for my parents and my family and to people from every corner of this broken earth to come here and make a great life here. We're one of the wealthiest places in the world. How is it that one of the wealthiest places in the world, if my mom had chest pains right now, I would stop and think, should I phone 911 or should I just go to the hospital myself with her? Because I don't know if there's enough ambulances out there. How does that happen in one of the wealthiest places in the world? So just because of who I am, and listen, I will call out Danielle Smith every day of the week. People know I'm not afraid to be pugilistic. But I also have tapped into something bigger about what people want for their families, for their kids, for their grandkids, for their communities. And to me, it was such a beautiful day when I was physically, weather-wise, it was such a beautiful day when I was standing in that room talking to those 500 people. And I said, to me, this feels like when you're in the mountains in the springtime and you hear a crack and the water starts to flow. We've been through this long, long, long UCP winter. And so the question is, now that it's cracked, now that people are feeling in their hearts that something better is possible, how do we capitalize that? How do we build on that? And how do we build for Alberta, for all of us? And if I can be the conduit for that, then I'm blessed to be able to do that.
I want to take, thank you for taking the time to chat today, sir. We've gone well over the time. I'm sure that there's your comms person is in the corner right now pulling their hair.
Well, no, I'm in my messy bedroom, which is why you get green screen on me here. But it is very true that I am 10 minutes behind on my next interview. And then I have a doctor's appointment that I'm now late for. So,
well, thank you very much for taking the time, sir. We're going to be trying to put together a Calgary debate because we're
fun.
Ambitious like that. So we will for sure be sending an invitation your way.
Get some save the dates in right away because the calendars are filling up fast. Particularly in the time between now and April 22nd. And oh, my comms person would have killed me. So I will say one last thing, which is this is a tight race, folks. So the membership deadline is April 22nd. April 22nd to May 22nd is kind of this weird period where you don't have your ballot yet, but you can't buy a membership. And so April 22nd to May 22nd is when the party is organizing all candidate debates and things like that. For that month. And then towards the end of May, people will get their ballot in the mail with a pin and you can vote online or by mail. And then the deadline to vote is June 22nd. And on June 22nd, the leader will be announced. So if you're interested in getting involved, you have till April 22nd to buy your membership. So go to nenshi.ca and pick up your membership and join the thousands of Albertans who've already done so.
There we go. Thank you very much for taking the time today, sir. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll be able to make a date work for that debate.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks for all you do. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, we would love nothing more than if you thought about signing up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab, where for just the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, you can help us continue to produce this kind of content. Whether you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, in which case, maybe leave a review and a rating, or whether you're watching it on one of our streaming platforms, we want to say a big thank you to everybody who is part of the Breakdown's audience. And as always, take care of each other and keep the conversation going.